How can faith and reason work together? Are they somehow mutually exclusive? What role do facts and evidence play in the Christian faith? This is Reasonable Faith, Conversations with Dr. William Lane Craig. I'm Kevin Harris, and today we're discussing Dr. Craig's book, Reasonable Faith. Now, I want to remind you as we begin this conversation that there are many resources like this podcast available at reasonablefaith.org. Dr. Craig, from time to time, I hear somebody say that we can't know history, and we know that from studying history.
Right.
I mean, can we actually use historical tools, historical methodology, and ascertain history? It's surprising to me that this is even a controversy, but it is something that you bring up, the problem of history, in your book, Reasonable Faith.
It is a problem, and it's vital to Christianity, Kevin, too, because Christianity, unlike most other world religions, is not a philosophy of life or a system of ethics. It is a historical narrative rooted in real people, real events, real places, things that actually happened. Moreover, the truth of Christianity is bound up in the historicity of those events. So that if, for example, it were shown that Jesus of Nazareth is just a mythological figure like Thor or Zeus, Christianity would be falsified. We would abandon Christianity if such a thing were shown. So the historicity of these events is vital to the truth of the Christian religion, and that makes Christianity unique, but it also means that we have a vital stake in the question of historical knowledge, and is it possible to know the past as it actually occurred? And during the past century and into the 21st century, there have been a number of folks who have denied that historical knowledge is possible, that you can really know the past as it occurred. And this is a vital debate for Christians, I think.
So they're skeptical about the extent to which we can know history?
Yes. Many times they'll say that historical facts are just in your head. There really aren't any such things as historical facts. They'll say facts have no meaning. It's the historian who gives them meaning. And especially in postmodernism, you get into a philosophy of history which says that there are no historical facts. All there are historical interpretations. Mm. Everything is interpretation. And your interpretation is just as good as my interpretation, so that there really isn't any way to know the past as it actually was. We're caught up in our own language and our own interpretations, and we never really get at reality.
Wow. Does that actually mean that I could read a history book and you could read a history book, and we could both come to radically different interpretations of what the historian said, and we'd both be right, in a sense, or because it's just interpretation?
Well, in a sense, it's almost more radical than that, because the claim is that the history book itself is written by a historian, so all you're really reading is just his interpretation of it. So not only is there your and my interpretation of what that historian said, but he himself has offered merely an interpretation of the past, which isn't objective and doesn't get back to the way the past really was. So it really leaves us in a bog of relativism and subjectivism, which I think undermines the confidence that we Christians have in the credibility, for example, of the New Testament records of the life of Jesus.
I guess the historian has always had to deal with whether the history writer was biased and whether you could
even trust
what he was writing, see through the filter of his bias and so forth.
Exactly. It's not a new problem in that sense.
Okay.
The problem of lack of neutrality has always been recognized by working historians. But what they've thought is that there are certain checks on this, and that by looking at the evidence, you can spot historical errors where bias has misled a historian. And moreover, there is a kind of core of historical facts which are agreed upon by all historians, whether they be Marxists or Democrats, Catholics or Protestants, Christians or non-Christians, so that working historians, I think, would be very resistant to this postmodernist subjectivism. In fact, working historians, I'm very grateful to say, have largely rejected this postmodernist view of history. It comes from certain postmodernist philosophers of history, but your working historian, fortunately, isn't buying into it.
I want to make sure that we know what postmodernism is. That might be kind of hard to define, but it's a view that is kind of raging for a while.
Yes, and the view is that we have now entered into a new era of thought. Modernism was the period of thought that ranged from, say, Descartes in the Age of Reason or the Enlightenment in Europe during the 17th and 18th centuries, and then lasted up until about World War I or so. That is the so-called modern age. And many self-proclaimed prophets of postmodernism claim that we are now living in a postmodern age. And what distinguishes this postmodern age is a disenchantment with objectivity, with our ability to get at truth and to know truth, with objective canons of rationality and logic. Postmodernists typically deny that there is any objective truth or canons of truth or rationality, and that even if there is an objective truth out there, they despair of our ever coming to know what it is. They would say that we are trapped within our own language, and our language determines how we experience the world and what we know, and we can't get outside of our language in order to see how reality really is. And so we're really trapped, we're prisoners of our own subjective thought forms and linguistic forms of thought.
Are there any signs, just taking a side road, mm-hmm. Dr. Craig, are there any signs that postmodernism is going away?
Yes. Yeah, there is. And that's, I'm so glad about that. In philosophy, which is my discipline, postmodernism has not made significant inroads. The overwhelming majority of philosophers recognize that logic expresses necessary truths, that there are objective canons of rationality, that we can know truth and know reality objectively. So that while there are postmodernist philosophers, these tend to be associated with European continental philosophy. But Anglo-American philosophy has been very resistant to this trend and has, I think, really exposed a lot of the silliness and fallacious arguments of postmodernism. Also, and I discovered this in doing my third revision of Reasonable Faith, in reading current philosophy of history, it is, again, acknowledged on all sides that history as a discipline has also resisted postmodernists. The postmodernist philosophers of history like Keith Jenkins and Hayden White and Anker Smith and others have not been able to persuade the community of historians that we cannot know the past as it actually was, that everything is interpretation. And so they also have been resisted by that discipline. Where postmodernists has made inroads tends to be in literary studies, literature, anthropology, sociology, and sadly enough, religious studies. Religious studies is just infected with postmodernism. But they've not been able to make significant inroads in philosophy, history, or I think the hard sciences.
Is this a kind of a historical skepticism?
Yes, quite definitely. It is. It's a historical skepticism which says you really can't know the past as it actually occurred. All you have is just your interpretations of the past, but you can't really know reality as it is in itself.
I would hope that if I were to write an historical account of my contemporary times, that even though I may be biased on some things, I'd still try to get the story straight. In other words,
right.
Can't biased people write history?
Absolutely. I mean, a good example of this would be Jewish survivors of the Holocaust. They are obviously biased in the sense that they have a vested interest in refuting the Holocaust deniers who deny there ever occurred a Holocaust. So they obviously are deeply emotionally invested in this. And yet, clearly, their testimony can be weighed and examined and be shown to be correct, that such a horrendous event really did occur, and that Holocaust deniers are simply wrong in denying that the Holocaust happened. And this is a real embarrassment for postmodernists, because they tend to be very politically correct and would find themselves very uncomfortable in being allied with neo-Nazis and people who deny the Holocaust ever occurred. This would make very uncomfortable bed partners for postmodernists. And yet, if you follow out postmodernism consistently, you have to say that the Holocaust denier is perfectly justified in that view, just as much as the people who say the Holocaust occurred and was a moral atrocity.
Yeah. If I were a postmodernist, I'd be upset if somebody interpreted my work differently than what I intended.
That's the irony, too. Yeah. What are these people writing books for if they think that they're
I could walk up and say, hey, I really enjoyed that book that you wrote about fleas on monkeys.
Yeah.
And they go, I didn't write that book. I go, oh, well, that's just my interpretation. You said that I could apply my own linguistic.
Or to say, to the postmodernists, what a brilliant defense of historical objectivity that you wrote. And I'm so glad you have shown how we can know the past as it actually is. Well, I'd be, you go ballistic. It's so self-refuting, Kevin. It's amazing that intelligent people can actually embrace this postmodernist view, because it refutes itself.
It's just fuzzy.
It's very fuzzy thinking.
Dr. Craig, one thing I do see, even among people who are not philosophers or who are not familiar with a lot of philosophy, they recognize and are appalled at historical revisionism.
Yes.
That tends to go on. So people are recognizing that this, even if they don't know what postmodern is, modernism is, and what historical revisionism is, they get angry when a movie imposes modern sensibilities and so forth upon that period piece,
yep,
making it look like modern people in a dressed up.
You rewrite history such that, say, I almost even hate to use such an example, but rewrite history and make a movie where Gandhi turns out to be a pedophile or something.
Yeah.
I mean, people would be outraged.
They would.
At such a distortion. And yet it would be licensed by this postmodernist view, and it would license the kind of rewriting of history that went on in the Soviet Union, for example, where it's been shown that tons of material were mashed to pulp and destroyed, and the history of the Bolshevik Revolution rewritten so that it was Stalin and Lenin who led the revolution, not Lenin and Trotsky. Everyone recognizes that the Soviets were guilty of propagandizing history, and yet that would be legitimized, just as Holocaust deniers would be legitimized by this kind of postmodernism.
But you said that postmodernism really affects literature and art more so than history.
Right, it does. And the people who are writing on these postmodernist views of history tend to treat history as literature, you see. They're not practicing historians who actually do the work. They are persons who look at history as just a kind of literature, a different genre. And they don't really see history as different than, say, a historical novel, where you write, a romance novel that has a historical setting. And so they treat history as literature rather than as serious grubbing around to try to actually get at the facts. In fact, I remember one article against postmodernism says, if postmodernists were correct, then the historian would never have to get out of his armchair and engage in something called research. Just spin it out of your own imagination.
Do you run into this on the university campus from time to time?
Well, now my answer might surprise you. The fact is, no, I never run into this.
Okay.
And I do not think that this kind of debate, which has gone on in academic, highly intellectual circles, has had a cultural influence. Hmm. And therefore, Kevin, I disagree fundamentally with people who say we live in a postmodern culture and that therefore we need to adopt new methods to reach postmoderns in our day and age. A postmodern culture would be an impossibility. It would be utterly unlivable. Nobody is a postmodernist when it comes to reading the label on a medicine bottle and the label on a box of rat poison. If you got a headache, you better believe texts have objective meaning. Otherwise, you're going to risk your very life. So what people are relativistic about is not science and technology and so forth. What they're relativistic about is religion and ethics. But you see, that's not postmodernism. That's modernism. That's just old line verificationism and positivism, which says that if you can't verify it with your five senses, it's just an expression of emotive tastes and personal preferences. So I think our culture is deeply, deeply modernist, not postmodernist. And therefore, people who say that appeals to logic, rationality, and evidence are ineffective and we need to abandon these and just tell our narrative are prescribing a suicidal course of action for Christianity. If we lay down our best weapons of logic, evidence, and argumentation and just share our narrative, what's going to happen is that Christianity will just become one more competing voice in a cacophony of voices, each one sharing his narrative and none of them claiming to have the objective truth about reality, while scientific naturalism marches on to tell us the facts about the way the world really is. So I think it's just vital in terms of doing cultural analysis that we not be misled by all of these people who say we live in a postmodern culture and have to adopt new methods to reach folks.
Why would people gravitate toward that? And maybe some of the radical thinkers that are in academia are thinking these things and it really doesn't get down to the culture. It hasn't trickled down really as much. Why would they want that? Because they have an agenda and they would want to revise history or put their own interpretation on a painting or a sculpture or Shakespeare, because it gives them autonomy? I what's the appeal?
Well, that's a really good question. And historically, I have seen suggested by people like John Searle, for example, at Berkeley, who is anti-postmodern. Searle says he thinks that what happened was the radicals of the 1960s. You remember the Vietnam War and so forth. He says the radicals of the 1960s wanted to take over the university, basically, and put through their agenda. But he said they found their way blocked in the traditional sciences, the hard sciences, and in philosophy, which was committed to classical standards of rationality and truth. And he says instead then they were able to find their way into the soft sciences, like sociology, anthropology, literary studies, and criticism. And so he basically thinks that what we're seeing is the fruit of the radicalism of the 1960s, who have now become ensconced in these areas at the university and are putting through their revisionistic, relativistic agenda in the name of postmodernism. Now, I'm not sure if that's true, but that's what Searle thinks, and he's certainly a credible source whose opinion needs to be respected. I also think on another level that the appeal of postmodernism is due to a misunderstanding of tolerance. In our democratic society, we have a deep commitment to the value of tolerance. And I think that today many people have the understanding that if you disagree with someone and say that they're wrong, that you are being intolerant and that therefore you cannot disagree with someone else's view. Every view must be true. Well, they can't all be objectively true because they're mutually contradictory. Therefore, truth must be relative and pluralistic. It's true for you, even if it's not true for me. And so you get this pluralistic kind of postmodernist view that says there is no objective truth. Truth is person relative, and everybody has his own truth and his own worldview. And I think it's this misunderstanding of tolerance that has made this postmodernism so appealing to people in our day and age. Now, in fact, as I say, I think it's based on a misunderstanding. When you think about the concept of tolerance, you can only tolerate a view if you think the view is false. If you think it's true, you don't tolerate it, you believe in it. So that the very concept of tolerance, when you reflect on it, entails that the tolerated view is thought to be not true. And that's why you tolerate it. So the very concept of tolerance entails objective truth. So objective truth is not incompatible with tolerance. It's presupposed by tolerance. So what tolerance really means is that even though I disagree with what you say, I will defend to the death your right to say it. That's the classical understanding of tolerance. The correct understanding of tolerance is rooted in the intrinsic worth of every human being who is created in the image of God and therefore endowed with certain inalienable rights, like freedom of thought and freedom of expression. And that's the correct basis and understanding of tolerance, not relativism.
Bottom line is, Dr. Craig, that the Christian can appeal to historical evidences to support his faith in Christ.
Absolutely. It is possible to know the past as it actually occurred. And I think when you turn to the Gospels, it's possible to show that these are credible historical documents for the life and the teachings of Jesus.
Dr. Craig, our question of the day, why do many students have a crisis of faith upon entering the university?
I suspect, Kevin, that they've been poorly trained in high school and particularly in their youth groups so that they've never encountered these sorts of questions before. I was talking this past year with a Christian minister at Stanford University, and he was sharing with me that according to statistics by George Barna, some 40% of our high school youth, upon graduating from high school, will never go back to church again. And he said many of these students don't really lose their faith in the university. He says they've already actually lost their faith by the time they come to the university. But while they're still living at home, they go through the motions in the youth group and the church activities until they're out from under mom and dad's authority, and then their real beliefs come out. So I think we're already losing the kids in high school, not to speak of university, and we need to do a better job in addressing these hard questions in our youth groups.
There's really not a problem in having your thinking challenged, and that's what will happen at the university. Is it just a matter of being prepared by what you're going to face?
Well, I think that's part of it. I mean, there are moral and spiritual issues involved here, too. I mean, let's face it, many students just don't want to follow Christ. They're not willing to take up his cross and follow in discipleship. That's plain. But there are others who have sincere questions that need to be addressed. And it's much better that these hard questions be addressed in a sympathetic and supportive context than in a hostile and challenging context. So I don't like to challenge people's faith, but I do like to challenge their thinking and to get them to really think hard and deep about these questions.
For more resources like these from Dr. William Lane Craig, go to reasonablefaith.org. That's reasonablefaith.org.